Okay, so we have a clipping in between chapters 5 and 6, and it's a clipping from Al Jazeera, the major media outlet, about the massive of deadly flooding, the Kerala floods, which displaced over 800,000 people and affected millions of people and was a huge disaster in that part of India in 2018. Chapter 6, Ellie, January 22nd, 2019, San Francisco and Berkeley, California. Ellie knew she shouldn't stop at the Boudin Bakery at the lobby level of 4 Embarcadero Center to order her usual coffee and sourdough English muffin because she only had 15 minutes before her first client appointment, but she really needed the jump start and ducked in anyway. She took out her phone, scanning her emails in an attempt to get a head start. This morning had been a Greek tragedy with Nathan, who normally went into daycare happily, clinging to her like a bridesmaid's shapewear, and she'd had to peel his little hands from her shoulders while he'd cried, "No, Mama, no." She'd heard his wails and she'd walked back to her car and had glanced back to see his little crumpled face before the daycare worker closed the door. She'd sat in the Odyssey and had to take 2 slow, deep breaths before she could start the engine. The special trip and extended time together in Chicago made it harder for Nathan now to detach. They had enjoyed the family time so much. She'd realized how important it was for them all to be together, and she felt guilt at not visiting her parents since the children were born. Strange how it took a death to unite them once again. This morning, she was meeting a new client who was an immigrant from India, and as Ellie raced out the door of Boudin, past the stay-at-home moms and nannies who came to the center's plaza, directly across from the ferry building, to enjoy the water features and art displays, she managed to pull up the client's intake file and start reading as the escalator carried her to the second floor of the ILDC. As she reached the lobby, she saw that 2 women dressed in saris, their dark hair in contrast to the beautiful pinks and greens of the silk, were already seated in the waiting room, among a number of other clients and babbling children. They were used to clients bringing their children, as many of the clientele had no child care or support whatsoever. Books in simple Spanish and donated toys and games had been added over time and were regularly scattered across the waiting room's threadbare carpeted floor. A set of crutches lay beside the client in the deep pink sari, and Ellie expected that was Hansa. She had come from Kerala in India after the terrible flooding there last year, which had left the entire district underwater and caused devastating landslides. "Half an hour early," confirmed the receptionist as she whispered to Ellie, who sped past, raising her eyebrows in apology. Ellie didn't like to appear flustered and generally didn't, but some mornings, like today, with a tragic Nathan and an exhausting weekend behind her, were more difficult than others. Ellie took a few moments in her office to compose herself while slurping her coffee and taking bites of her buttery muffin before returning to the waiting room and calling for Hansa Nair. Warily, Hansa stood with her crutches. The woman beside her also rose. Ellie pointed the way and let Hansa set the pace, hopping towards the office, her crutches making a tap, tap, tap on the laminate flooring. Inside her office, Ellie shook hands with a despondent Hansa who barely met her gaze. The younger woman, Hansa's sister, Rashila, she informed Ellie, in contrast, shook her hand firmly and looked her dead in the eye. It was easy to see who was the more dominant sister. Hansa clasped a set of papers to her chest as she sat stiffly in her chair. "Tell me what happened that brought you here today, in your own words, Hansa," said Ellie, gently, as she leaned towards the 2 women, pen in hand. Ellie preferred not to have a keyboard and computer screen between her and her clients, especially in a first meeting. "My sister has a very good case," blurted Rashila, not even giving Hansa a chance to speak. "She was treated very badly, and look how she has been left. She cannot walk properly and can't afford the hospital fees. What can she do?" Hansa did not look up. "I can help," said Ellie encouragingly. "Hansa, if you, in your own words, could tell me what happened?" "They left oil on the floor," Rashila cried, animated. "Olive oil. What did they expect would happen? That back room was a death trap, and rats too, and customers buying those things and rats running all around. They should be closed down. Ellie inhaled. This wasn't uncommon. The injured worker who would come in had been so beaten down by their situation, often leading to depression and a lack of confidence that meant they could barely talk for themselves. They often brought a more outspoken family member, but Ellie needed to hear from Hansa herself. Rashila, I appreciate you coming with your sister today. I can see how much you care about her. Now, if you could let Hansa speak, as I need to hear it from her. Rebuke heeded, Rashila reluctantly sat back in her chair. I gotta pause for a second. I was taking in a delivery, murmured Hansa after a pause. We always got most of our deliveries on a Tuesday. You had to unpack the boxes, check the invoices, put them into the system, and get them out onto the shop floor. You had to make room, and you had to try and find somewhere to store the new stock. It was always the busiest day. Yes, encouraged Ellie, glad that she was finally getting some detail. Hansa's voice was mouse-like, faltering as she spoke. Rashila squirmed. Roberto brought the boxes in from the truck. He opened them up for me, you know, because they came on these pallets, and that day a big pallet had fallen, and all these bottles of olive oil had rolled out and smashed, and he was very annoyed and said he wasn't cleaning it up, as it wasn't his fault, but I did not think it was my job to clean it up, as I only took in the stock for the shelves, and I also had a shop full of customers. Ellie nodded intently while taking notes. She sensed Rashila settling down now. The words rushed more urgently from Hansa. So I went back to the shop floor because the atmosphere was very bad, and Roberto was kicking boxes and everything, and I came back later, maybe an hour later, as the shop was busy, but I knew I had to get this stock in or our boss would be very angry, and I walked out, and the oil had leaked all across the floor, and still Roberto had not cleaned it up, and I slipped right up into the air and landed on a box of cookies, you know, all packaged up. It was hard, rock hard, and I came down on my knee on the corner, and I felt a pop, and oh, the pain. It had gone out of place, and I couldn't get up. And I called for Roberto, but he wasn't there, and I lay there for a long time because he never came back, and there only was Fadila in the shop, and she found me because she was going on her lunch, but she couldn't get me off the floor as I couldn't move, and so they called the ambulance. I was crying. It was terrible. She finally took a breath, and Ellie could tell she was right back in that moment, reliving the trauma. Ellie spread out the photos of the stockroom of the discount dollar store in Fremont where Hansa worked. Rashila had included them in the initial intake inquiry in an envelope of paperwork, including a mess of Hansa's medical bills, their travel and visa documents, a flyer they'd found on workers' rights, and screenshot printouts of menacing passive-aggressive texts from her employer. The stockroom was a disaster zone. Exposed wiring hung from the ceiling, looping over patchy holes in the drywall, revealing yards of pink fiberglass that any employee in there would be breathing. Hansa had taken a picture of a hole in the wall, which she said Roberto had punched, to demonstrate the rage issues she'd faced with him and some close-ups of rodent droppings. Through the text printouts, Ellie could see that the sisters had been in regular contact about the conditions at the store, and the texts and photographs were good evidence. Hansa had not returned to the store or any other job since her accident. In her quiet, faltering voice, Hansa explained to Ellie what it had been like to work at the discount dollar store, as well as the endless tasks of unpacking, stocking, stacking shelves, and serving customers. The stock job, she realized, the more Hansa spoke, was certainly part of Roberto's job, which he was shirking. She had been given late-night shifts, week after week, despite requesting that she be rostered for the shifts she was told she'd be working when she'd first taken the job. This meant manning and closing the store late at night on her own, next to a convenient mart known to be a hot spot for drug dealers. Shoplifting was rife at the dollar store, something the manager had told Hansa was her fault when it happened and even threatened to deduct from her wages. "And what have the doctors said about your injury?" asked Ellie, kindly. "Going forward." Hansa met Ellie's gaze for the first time. "Total knee replacement." The three women let the silence sit for a moment. "Well, Hansa," said Ellie, leaning even further forward to show compassion, "as far as I can see, we have a serious and willful misconduct claim here, alongside the standard underlying workers' compensation injury claim. I've read through the text correspondence from your employer, and it's unconscionable. If you would like me to proceed, I can start the paperwork to file with the Workers' Compensation Appeals Board. This will start disability payments for you and keep your treatment going. As for your medical bills, try to put them out of your mind, as we'll be holding the insurance carrier responsible for those, past and future. These cases do tend to take some time, longer than you'll like, but it's the mechanism we have for this sort of claim, and we're here to make sure you receive all of the compensation and benefits available. Yes, said Rashila. That would be very good. Thank you. Ellie nodded. She sensed she hadn't heard the full story, that there was more to this, but it was enough for a first meeting that had been difficult for Hansa. If you find anything else in the meantime, correspondence, photographs, or think of anything else you need to add, just send it straight to me. Ellie took a business card from a holder on her desk and handed it across. Rashila leaned forward to take it so that Hansa did not have to move. She seemed to anticipate how every movement was now painful for her sister. You know, this is my job. I see cases like this every day, and I will do everything in my power to help you, Hansa. You came to the right place. Hansa did not lift her head, but nodded slightly. Rashila pursed her lips. Thank you, Miss Benvenuto, she said. Rashila didn't add any more platitudes, but Ellie could tell by her slumped shoulders as she left the office that she finally felt some sense of relief, and that they might, just might, be finding the help they needed in their desperate situation. You're very welcome, Rashila, she said, as she smiled and regarded the sisters as they all made their way, slowly, carefully, out to the lobby. Hansa was terrified to fall again, Ellie realized, as she watched her crutch past reception. She knew how much life could change in an instant with one small slip. One moment could change everything forever. How was Chicago? Good trip? Asked Joe as Ellie shuffled Nathan and Luca through the door of his spacious townhouse and stayed on the doorstep as they toddled in, Nathan heading straight for the toys their father kept in a big wooden chest, Luca for the old beanbag Joe had taken with him after the divorce. Yes, good, said Ellie, not wanting to appear rude, but really, really needing to be down those steps and back into her car. It was early evening as she dropped the kids off, and she felt guilty again about all the shuttling around that day. They had only flown in from Chicago yesterday evening, and after Nathan's meltdown at daycare that morning, she'd had to pick him up after work, rush home to meet Luca off his bus, and fold everyone back into the car to drop them off at Joe's so that she could get to UC Berkeley Law School, where she was supervising at the Workers' Rights Clinic that evening. And another awe-inspiring Tuesday of acrobatic, suspenseful, time-space-defying mothering would be commemorated by no one. The clinic was a partnership between the school's Civil Rights Clinic and the ILDC and offered a double whammy of interesting employment law lectures from expert guest speakers for law school clinic students for the first hour, followed by two more hours of practicum, where the students interviewed and advised workers on their rights and whether they might be able to take legal action. The workers who came to the clinic got the advice for free, but it had to be supervised by licensed lawyers, which is where Ellie came in, taking turns with other ILDC attorneys on a rotation. It was nice to see Mom and Dad and spend the time, you know, said Ellie as she turned for the steps. The boys loved the snow. I'll bet, said Joe. Joe had offered to come to Ellie's flat for convenience, but Ellie didn't really want her ex-husband spending hours in what was now her own personal and private space. Neither could they stay the night with Joe's early work hours and Luca's bus set to arrive at her flat in the morning. This did mean she'd be getting the boys to bed late on clinic mentoring nights like this. Perhaps that was selfish, but she couldn't keep piling on more reasons to feel guilty. And how are you feeling, you know, after Enzo? He meant Enzo. Fine, said Ellie brightly. Too brightly. Well, I mean, you know. She turned away again. This was awkward. I've been reading this diary, she said, turning back again and now realizing something. I found it in Enzo's house, in his things. It's the diary of my great-great-grandmother, Theodora, Teddy. No way, said Joe, smiling. I was reading it on the plane home. I'm nearly finished with it, and I was thinking of our family and Enzo and all about this young woman that would have been his grandmother, and all the time I was reading, I felt... Her voice trailed off. I don't know. It felt comforting, not sad. Ellie checked her watch. I really gotta run, she said, and taking the steps two at a time, hopped back into her car. One of the perks of working at the ILDC that in fact did underpay her, as was not lost on her father, was a parking space at 4 Embarcadero Center, which was right at a BART station, the San Francisco Bay Area's commuter rail system. Ellie parked her car to take BART to the downtown Berkeley station to avoid rush hour traffic across the Bay Bridge. It was an easy walk to the UC Berkeley campus from there. It was also an opportunity to keep reading Teddy's diary. She found herself thinking about the diary and longing to pick it up again whenever she had a few spare minutes. Every time she'd read it, she felt sucked back in time, like she was right there. She thought of nothing else while she read, and her heart sank that she was nearing the end of it now. She savored the pages, one by one, lost to her relation, now long gone. She only had a few pages left to read. She didn't want her connection to Teddy to end, and so she was eking out the pages like a fine wine, line by line, sip by sip. As long as she was reading that diary, she was connected to Enzo and Genevieve. It was hard to explain, but that's how she felt. Grief could be funny like that. Better to dance with it than to wrestle. The one regret she had about her weekend in Chicago was not getting around to finding Genevieve's things down in the basement. Her mother had seemed somehow disinterested, and they'd been busy, so Ellie had not pushed it. She felt drained before she even made her way to the small lecture room in the law school building at the corner of Bancroft and Piedmont Avenue, directly across from Cafe Strada. Professor Eleanor Hayes already stood before the new class of law clinic students, her presence commanding. The walls, lined with legal tomes that bore witness to decades of jurisprudential evolution, seemed to lean in, as if eager to contribute to the wisdom she was about to impart, although the reality was that most of the books were rarely dispatched from their shelves in favor of modern digital research methods. "Good evening, everyone," Professor Hayes began. "Tonight, we delve into the fundamentals of employment discrimination law, an active and constantly evolving field that tests both our legal acumen and our commitment to equality." She paced slowly in front of the whiteboard, clicking her laser pointer to life and illuminating a slide titled "The Anatomy of an Employment Discrimination Case." "First, let's understand the foundation in establishing what we call a prima facie case," she continued, pointing to the first bullet point. "Discrimination in the workplace occurs when an employee is treated unfavorably, not just for any reason, but because of a protected category, such as race, color, religion, sex, sexual orientation, pregnancy or related condition, national origin, age, disability, to name a few. These protected categories are cataloged in federal and state legislation and in turn interpreted by the courts. The words discrimination and harassment often get bandied about casually, but they are legal terms of art with specific elements that must be satisfied. Just because something is unfair doesn't mean it's illegal or actionable. For any discrimination or workplace harassment case to go forward at all, it must have some hook on a protected category." Ellie smiled as she listened. It had been years since she herself had sat like these fresh-faced law students in this very building. Now she was working in the exact field being outlined by Hayes. Almost all of the cases she handled at the ILDC came back to a prejudice from the employer, not always apparent at first. The students, a mix of eager alongside apprehensive and mostly young faces, typed notes into their laptops as Hayes transitioned from point to point. "Identifying a potential claim involves not just recognizing these biases, but understanding how they manifest in hiring, promotions, job assignments, and terminations. In other words, actionable adverse actions. It's about the subtleties, the patterns, and most crucially, the impacts." Hayes clicked to a new slide featuring a case study involving a qualified female employee overlooked for a promotion in favor of a less qualified male colleague. "Let's dissect this," she proposed, her tone now more interactive. "What aspects of this situation suggest discrimination? How do we approach analyzing the viability of this scenario as a colorable claim?" A hand shot up, and Professor Hayes nodded to a young woman in the second row. "If the promotion criteria were supposedly based on performance metrics, but we can demonstrate that those metrics were applied inconsistently, would that satisfy for a prima facie case?" the earnest student asked, her voice tinged with both curiosity and uncertainty. Hayes' eyes lit up with approval. "Inconsistency in the application of supposedly objective criteria, for example, height and weight requirements that used to be in place for flight attendants and firefighters, can indeed suggest bias. This is what we would call a disparate impact case. The other typical manifestation of discrimination is called a disparate treatment case. Establishing a prima facie case doesn't require absolute proof of discrimination initially. In fact, most evidence is circumstantial. It's about showing that an unlawful motive could plausibly be at play, and then a nexus between that motive and the actions that were taken, and whether those qualify as actionable adverse actions. She walked back to the podium, tapping the screen to bring up a flowchart of the legal process in such cases, from first exhausting internal complaint procedures within the workplace to filing a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, to the potential for litigation. As future defenders of justice, you'll often start here at the EEOC. It's crucial to understand their procedures, the importance of timely filing, and how mediation can often resolve issues. 85% of employment discrimination cases are settled short of trial. Professor Hayes spent the rest of her lecture diving deeper, gathering evidence, the importance of meticulous documentation, and the ethical considerations that might guide their actions. Each point was punctuated with real cases, the nuances illustrating the harsh realities of the legal landscape. As the lecture neared its end, Hayes looked over her class, a sense of solemnity settling over the room. "Remember," she concluded, "this field isn't just about legal victories. It's about people. It's about fairness, dignity, and making our society a little more just with every case. For the next 2 hours, you'll be taking in information from workers waiting in the library who may or may not have a valid claim, then debriefing with your mentoring attorneys here in this room, before returning to the worker with legal advice that you explain to them in an understandable way." When Hayes dismissed the students, Ellie rose from her seat and quickly made her way to the professor, who was collapsing her laptop and rolling up the charger. "Professor Hayes," said Ellie, reaching out her hand to shake the seasoned veterans. "Ellie Benvenuto, I'm one of the supervising attorneys tonight, ILDC. I just wanted to say your lecture resonated with me. I'm new to this area of law, and it's been a challenge, but I appreciate how you summed it up, making our society a little more just with every case you handle." Professor Hayes thrust her now encased laptop into Ellie's chest. "Carry this to my car, will you? I have arthritis and there was no one here to help me earlier." Taken aback, Ellie blinked. "Oh, sure," she said, and watched as the prickly professor packed up the rest of her things. "Sheesh," thought Ellie as she followed Hayes out of the now empty lecture hall towards the parking lot. So much for "it's about the people." She made a mental note should she ever have the pleasure of addressing her own students. "Kindness and empathy go a long way," she would tell them. "These qualities are not a nice to have, they are an imperative."